Good morning to everybody. This moment in Matthew, of which Chris has read to us just now, is known, though it's a whole paragraph, by one verse. That's verse 28. Come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. We've been singing the tenderness and the beauty of the paragraph by that verse just now. Some of us are Christians because of that one verse. And some of us, very likely, are even here this morning because of it. When you leave this auditorium, if you go out that door, you'll walk right by Matthew 11 and verse 28. Come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden. I think what happens here at the end of Matthew chapter 11 is appreciated that way by that one verse. But I want to say to you that what happens at that time may be underestimated that way too, and perhaps even misunderstood. I'd like to suggest that as we read this important paragraph, the at that time, which begins it, offers us the viewpoint that we need, and I think a great deal of the meaning it may have in our lives right now. Most of you, if you think about it, can realize that the timing of a message or a reading can have a great deal to do with its impact and its application for us. So consider the at that time here. One striking thing about this time in its setting is its setting in the broader context of Matthew's telling of the story of Jesus. If you consider what goes on here, at the end of Matthew chapter 9, we have Jesus having gone through all the cities and the villages, teaching the people and dealing with all of the huge variety of troubles in their lives, being moved to the depth of his being with compassion for them. He sees that they are distressed and downcast, like sheep who don't have a shepherd, who can fall over, get turned over, get soaked or waterlogged, get overwhelmed by it, and be completely helpless. They're harassed and helpless like people who have hurts that nobody cares about. When Jesus looks at it, he doesn't see a situation which he turns away from in disgust. He sees a great need where there is a harvest that is huge, especially compared to those laborers who are available to work in it, who are much fewer. And then we move into chapter 10 of Matthew, and we see Jesus giving 12 men authority to go out and to deal with the lost sheep of the house of Israel. It's significant that they're referred to that way at this time, Matthew 10 and verse 6. He wants the 12 to tell them the kingdom of heaven is at hand, which all sounds good and wonderful until you begin to read through this chapter. And he says, I'm sending you like sheep in the midst of wolves. He tells them, you're going to be dragged before governors and kings, and they're going to flog you in their synagogues. He tells them a little farther that it's going to cause sometimes their own families to let them down, and they'll be hated by all men for his name's sake. And he explains that none of you are any better than me, he says. No servant is better than his master. They're going to treat you like they will eventually treat me. Then he starts telling them, don't be afraid. Have no fear of them. He tells them that about five times. And the bottom line is that they're to have a greater fear for the one who could destroy soul and body in hell than of anybody or of anything that might be done to them. And then in chapter 11, we come across John the Baptist, who is the Lord's forerunner, who's been sent to prepare the way from him, the way for him. The problem is that John the Baptist is at this time lingering in old Herod's prison, soon to be removed of his head and have it carried to the daughter of old Herodias on a platter as a gift. Jesus gets a message or messengers from his forerunner. Verse 3, are you the one we're looking for? Or are we waiting for another? Jesus then offers reassurance to the doubts that John is enduring at that moment, the understandable doubts that John is enduring at that moment. And then he strongly rebukes the lack of repentance and the stubbornness of so many of the places where his mighty works have been done, finally saying it'll be more tolerable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom than for you. At that time, Jesus said what he does in this passage. Now please consider what that tells us. Jesus was not offering an easy way. He was not promising the people who followed him that they would be excused from having any responsibility or any challenges in their lives. And you can see it at that time in the setting in this book. Jesus is not a demagogue who comes along making false promises to people that cannot possibly be real in order to gain a huge following for himself. So whatever he means here will not have an application that contradicts the setting in which the words are spoken. Now there's a second thing about what happened at that time that makes us stop and think. And it's the surprising prayer of Jesus in verses 25 and 26. Father, I thank you, Lord of heaven and earth, I thank you that you have hidden these things from the wise and understanding and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for such was your good pleasure, or your gracious will, it may be translated. Now think about that also at that time. That can't mean, given the time, that God did not want some people to accept what they were being told about him through Jesus. And it can't mean that God was trying to keep some people from seeing and understanding and being blessed by what the Lord was doing. Jesus himself is just going through the whole countryside, hurting with compassion and trying to help these people. He was praying for laborers. He sent his disciples. He had them be willing to face all the kinds of opposition they would face. He had to reassure John and to rebuke the unbelief that was there because it wasn't what God would have preferred. So what is this prayer all about, this thanksgiving? The Lord is giving thanks for who could see what he was saying. Alexander McLaren, who was a prolific and a wonderful writer of more than 100 years ago now, commenting about this, observed, "Every apparent exclusion of any is but the result of its free offer to all." Now think about what he means. The reason some people could not see what was being revealed by the Father through His Son is that they were not willing to see it on the same basis of those who knew less, had less, and had been less than they had themselves. What if what Jesus is saying here is simply the application of the first of the Beatitudes? Listen to them from Matthew 5. "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied." And Luke's telling of this in Luke chapter 6, you may observe the other part, the other side of the story, and what Jesus means about this being hidden from some people. In Luke 6, at verse 20 beginning, Luke has his tells his summary of this in the Sermon on the Plain. But when he gets down to verse 24, he says, But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you shall be hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe to you when all people speak well of you, for so their fathers did not, or did to the false prophets." You can see what he's getting at. What the Lord is saying is there are some people who are going to be able to see and accept what's offered to them in the kingdom because they're looking for it and they're hungry for it and they know they need it. And there are some people who are not going to be willing to see it or be blessed by it or to accept the rule of the Lord in it because they don't think they need it. They think they know more. Some of us think we know more than He does. We enjoy what we have now without Him. We think we are better than someone who would simply accept the gospel of Jesus by faith through grace according to His will. 1 Corinthians chapter 1 offers a wonderful illustration of how this works out after the cross. Beginning at verse 19, Paul writes about the meaning of Jesus in the lives of many of these Corinthians. He makes the point that the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to those who are being saved, it's the power of God. He says in verse 20, "Where's the wise? Where's the one who's wise? Where's the scribe? Where's the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world?" He goes ahead to make the point about what people look for and so forth. He says, "When the world through its wisdom knew not God, it pleased God through the folly of preaching to save those who believe." And you look on down here and he says in verse 26, "We consider you, and you consider your calling, not many of you are wise according to worldly standards. Not many are powerful. Not many are of noble birth. God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what's weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what's low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, that no human being might boast in the presence of God." Now that is the prayer that Jesus is offering at this time. Now, with those two things lingering in our minds, we can consider that it is there having been made at this time that underscores the spectacular implications of the Lord's claims. So we've seen the setting and Matthew's story and the surprising prayer of Jesus, and now the spectacular implication. The first is, he is claiming that he stands in a relation to the Father and to people that no one else possibly could. There never has been anyone like this, and there never will be anyone like this, because there cannot be anyone like Jesus. And that's why it says in verse 27, all things have been handed over to me by my Father, that no one knows the Son except the Father, no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. That's what is being told us in the Gospel of Matthew. The birth of Jesus demonstrates it. His baptism and transfiguration, both times Matthew records the voice, "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased." The authority with which Jesus taught, "You've heard it said, but I say." He's the one who could tell us what Scripture means, who can make known God. His mighty works in nature, in people's lives, in dealing with death or with the spiritual world, all of those things are meant to say, there's nobody else like this. At the end of Matthew, he can say, all authority has been in heaven and earth has been given to me. Think of the implication of that. You and I are subject to what he thinks of us. We're subject to his authority and his rule. And if we're not now, we will be. You can see that. Second, he is claiming that he has both the ability and the willingness to give any of us a kind of rest which can be found nowhere else. Now, this is either true or it is the claim of a crazy man who has a hugely overinflated view of himself, so much so that we would consider him to be unbalanced. To say, "Here are my arms, everybody in the whole world who labors and is heavy laden, come lay your head on my breast, and I'll comfort you. I'll give you rest." To say that and not be able, that's some sense. Everyone who labors, that is, who works and is worn out by it and is tired by what life demands, everyone who is heavy laden, who bears sorrow and hurt, everyone, then come to me. I will give you rest. I'll give you relief. I'll give you peace. You'll find rest for your souls. You notice all the July 4th sales of bedding companies? How many different ads have you seen or heard about what kind of rest could be provided? I'll tell you one kind you never heard anybody promise. Maybe for your back, maybe for your physical body, nobody promised you rest for your soul, because nobody could give it. I ran across, in working on this, a statement from Psalm 116 that I think might help us understand what this means. It said in verse 3, "The snares of death encompassed me. I suffered distress and anguish. I called on the name of the Lord. O Lord, I pray, deliver my soul, my life, my personality, my spirit," in other words. Then verse 5, "Gracious is the Lord and righteous. Our God is merciful. The Lord preserves the simple. When I was brought low, He saved me. Return, O my soul, to your rest, for the Lord has dealt bountifully with you. For you have," now here's the rest. Look at this. This is rest for the soul. "For you've delivered my soul from death, my eyes from tears, my feet from stumbling. I will walk before the Lord in the land of the living." That's what Jesus is saying He can do for people, all kinds of people with all kinds of hurts and problems. And then, Jesus claims that this kind of rest comes through a voluntary loyalty to Himself that obeys Him and imitates Him in life. I don't have a lot of time with this one, but I want you to see the idea that's here. That's what He means when He says, "Come to Me. Make companionship with Me the leading factor in your whole life, the thing that dominates everything else. Walk in the same way I walk. Abide with Me," 1 John 2 and verse 6. What does that mean? Well, take My yoke on you. The yoke is what put an oxen under the, and the strength of an oxen under the control of the farmer. It was used religiously sometimes in terms of what someone taught or demanded of someone else. And it would mean to submit yourself to someone's rule, or in plain words, to obey Jesus. To give yourself, to have a kind of loyalty to Him that causes you to willingly do what He asks us all to do in our lives. And to have an obedience that actually causes us to imitate Him in how we go about our everyday lives. Morally speaking, in Ephesians 4 and verse 20, to learn Christ means to get rid of darkness and all that it involves, and to put on the new man who's created after God in righteousness and truth. Not darkness and lust and all of that, but righteousness and truth. Socially speaking, to learn Christ means to have His mind and His attitude, which causes us to empty ourselves, to become a servant to everybody, and to have a heart that is gentle and humble. And spiritually speaking, to learn Jesus, to follow His example, means to bear whatever suffering comes along, 1 Peter 2 and verses 20 and following, and to keep on entrusting ourselves to God and to His justice. That is to learn Christ. Now what Jesus says is, "I'm gentle and lowly in heart. I am the servant God promised in Isaiah 42, and I'm the one who gave Himself, who will give Himself for everybody," from Isaiah 53. "I'm not here to lay terrible, hard burdens on you. I'm here," Jesus is saying, "to serve you and to help you, and to submit to My will and to My word. To take My yoke and to learn of Me will be a blessing in your life and not a burden." The gentleness and the lowly spirit of Jesus should be responded to with a heart which says, here's what it means to love God. It's to do what He says, to do His commandments, and to not regard them as a burden, 1 John 5 and verse 3, because it's what you really, really want to do. Is anybody here weary and heavy laden? It's interesting in Luke's account of this moment that Matthew has, right before this, Jesus says, what you need to rejoice in is in having your name written in heaven. And right after this, He says, the one who's really blessed is the one who sees the Father's will that prophets have long wanted to look into. That's Luke 10, verse 18 to 20. In 23 and 24. So that brings us to the question, can we see this? Do we believe it? And at this moment, at this time, is this the ruling conviction in our lives? That we'll find rest for our souls in company with Jesus, and under His rule, and following His example. At this time, is that where I am? This whole thing is an invitation. Jesus is saying the answer to that can be yes. And that's what He wants for us all. And if we can help you in that way this morning, would you please indicate that that's your desire by coming here while we stand and sing this song.